Hello and welcome to the Managing Uncertainty podcast. I'm Brian Strauser, Principal and Chief Executive here at BrightPath. In this week's episode, I have an interview with one of my favorite people in emergency management, Dan Stoneking. Dan is currently the founder and vice president of the Emergency Management External Affairs Association. But prior to this, he was the director of the Office of the Private Sector at FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and then later the head of external affairs in FEMA Region 3, which is based in Pennsylvania and covers several of the mid-Atlantic states. Without further ado, here's my interview with Dan Stoneking. I'm here with my friend Dan Stoneking. Dan, thanks for taking some time to join us for the Managing Uncertainty podcast.
Thanks, Brian. It's always good to see you.
Dan, let's start with your story. Who is Dan Stoneking? Walk us a little bit through your journey and how you wound up in emergency management.
It starts at college, but I'll fast forward quickly. I did major in communications. So I always wanted to be in some kind of communications role. But I got a scholarship to the Army that took me in that direction. I did air defense, I did combat arms, combat support. And towards the end of my career, I got involved in public affairs. And so I started that in the Army. I carried that through FEMA and I have it through to this day. So I think communicating effectively, honestly, and sincerely with folks is essential to our success as a nation or in any institution.
Mm-hmm. Was there a particular moment where you realized that this is the work that you really wanted to do, that you were built to do this thing?
Yeah. So in terms of the emergency management side of the house, I can almost bring it down to an absolute moment. And it was during the response to Hurricane Katrina, I responded as a soldier. I had not yet worked with FEMA yet. And I saw a lot of people make mistakes, as you can imagine, right? Anybody who knows Katrina, there was a lot of mistakes made by a lot of parties. And a few folks did some really good things. But as an objective source from the outside, I saw FEMA's getting an unfair rap here, those poor guys, because I saw how committed they were. I saw the hard work they were doing and the long hours they kept. And I thought, I want to be part of that. Because for two reasons. One, I worked in the National Guard, and I'd like to think that I helped the National Guard's reputation grow stronger and help people realize how much they were doing overseas as well as in their states to help communities. And I thought, wow, I think FEMA could use a little more help telling their story because folks just aren't getting how valuable they are.
You were the director of the private sector office at FEMA. That's actually the first place I met you. What were some of the challenges you faced when you walked into that role? And what did you start to do to address those?
There's a few challenges. One, we were fairly new. So hadn't really established the standard operating procedures and strategies and so forth. Two, I only had four people working for me. And four can be a lot of people depending on what you're going to do. But when you're dealing with and interacting with 85% of America, that's not a lot. And then third and finally, I realized, to no fault of their own, we all have different experiences, but much of the FEMA leadership until Craig Fugate got there, and I started this role prior to his arrival, but until he got there, much of the leadership didn't really understand the value of the private sector, and they would talk at them instead of with them. And I'll just give one example. I remember the operators, well-intended, wanted to go to Walmart and get them to sign a memorandum where Walmart would be responsible for all the infant and toddler kits in any disaster. And I knew before any conversation, Walmart would reject that, which they did, because why put themselves in a position of responsibility and guilt if they didn't have to? So I realized the position and the greatest challenge was we had to be both operationally focused and knowledgeable, as well as understanding how to communicate with people and not talking at them.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that started during your tenure was the National Business Operations Center, or the NBEOC, often cited as a key innovation during that time. Can you talk a bit about how that came together and the successes you had with that initiative?
So first of all, the first success came from how we created it. And we created that together with the public sector and the private sector. We looked at other models like New York City and Louisiana and some others and took those lessons learned and asked those individuals to help us build our model. And so we built it in a collaborative way. Second of all, people sometimes argued this at the beginning, but the name mattered, right? So the states and cities were calling it BEOCs, and we had some bureaucrats in FEMA who didn't want to call it that because that sounded too operational. And that's why I say you need somebody in this role who's operational, but also understands networking and coalition building. So we got the program right, we got the name right, and then it became an open dialogue. And in the entire time I was there, I responded to every single email I ever received, whether it was in a disaster or in steady state. And that two-way communication, I think, was the foundation to every success we had.
After your time there at headquarters, you moved out to FEMA Region 3 as the Director of External Affairs. And so, what was that move like for you? How did that kind of change your work? I realize your scope changed a lot. It's a much broader role as you got closer to the ground there. But talk to me a little bit about what that transition was like.
So I knew it would be a bigger fish in a smaller pond kind of thing. I had had two young baby girls at that time, and I'll be honest in all humility to say I thought I was transitioning to a simpler and easier life, you know, because there's always disaster somewhere. I thought, well, if I'm just focused on Region 3, it should be nice and easy comparatively. But I walked in the door on the day Superstorm Sandy hit, and that impacted all six of our states. And in the time since, and I'll forget some, but just some examples, we had several national special security events. We had the COVID that impacted everybody. We had the DNC convention. We had the papal visit. And then even in the last week, as I was retiring almost 2 years ago now, we had the train derailment on the border of Ohio and Pennsylvania. And when you border two states plus two regions, that provides a lot more complications. And then I had the great honor to work for Mary Ann Tierney, who is one of the smartest people in emergency management. But if somebody's moving the train fast, the conductor's probably Mary Ann Tierney, right? So I walked in not knowing how difficult that position would be, but ended up being really grateful because, in addition to everything I just said, you're a little bit close to the ground. So at headquarters, you can hope to see changes you make when you look back over a year, policy changes and so forth. But at the region level, you're deploying more often, you're interacting directly with states and survivors, and you see the instant validation of the hard work you put in and the difference you make.
I guess I hadn't realized how broad that role was until I was preparing, the questions I wanted to talk through with you today. And I looked at your LinkedIn profile and realized how many things fell under that role in external affairs in a region. How did you balance all of those different, responsibilities that fell under that role?
Sure. So I walked in the door. Obviously, I was an expert in private sector because I came from the national job. I felt pretty confident in my public speaking and all of the media roles because I've done that since I was in the military. But I was able to make it out of headquarters without spending very much time at all doing intergovernmental, congressional, tribal, and community preparedness, which also fell under the umbrella. So I started with you count on the people who are doing a great job in those roles first, and you learn from them. And where you're either missing staff or less experienced staff, I had to dig in and learn really quick. And I did it the same way I did the private sector job by listening to our stakeholders. I learned so much more about tribal relations from tribes than I ever learned from FEMA policy. And so I found that to be, you know, really helpful to listen and learn, and you have to do a lot of homework in that job, and you have to build relationships. But in the end, I learned so much more about the three areas I wasn't experienced in, and saw that in the end of the day, they can really work well together. Because most of the things you want to say, with some minor edits, are going to work for any audience, and most of the stakeholders want information, they want it fast, and they want it to be right. So if you learn some few basic skills, those are appreciated by different audiences.
You retired from FEMA about 2 years ago now, and now you are the founder and vice president of a new association, the Emergency Management External Affairs Association. So tell us a little bit about the new association, what inspired you to help found this group, and what role you see this playing in the broader emergency management community.
So anybody who knows me knows that I have a lot of energy and I don't like to sit still. So when I retired, I wrote a book, I wrote poetry, I rode my bike, and I just wasn't filling up all my time. And one day I was just sitting there thinking, and it hit me like a bolt of lightning that there is a gap. There are some outstanding public relations associations, PRSA. There's even a government association for communicators that does a great job, but they cover the spectrum. And the government association doesn't welcome, isn't open to private sector. PRSA is open to everybody, but they don't focus on emergency management. So I thought, wow, that's the gap. So we're going to focus just on emergency management, but public and private sector, whether you're congressional, intergovernmental, any of those skills where you interact with the public are all welcome. And folks got really excited quickly, and we started to build it. And I reached out to folks who are experts in their field, who had different skill sets to be on our board of directors and to help us build this thing. And here's where I see it now and why I think it's so important. We've seen countless columns. I wrote one myself about what we can expect to see change in FEMA in the months, years ahead. So a change in FEMA is a change to the entire landscape. In addition to those changes in the structure of emergency management, we are seeing a massive exodus of seasoned public affairs crisis communicators. Regretfully, we've had just a handful of outstanding experts in the last year pass away. And that's a tragic loss to our field, and so many others retiring. So, what we offer is the ability for folks to network, to learn, to collaborate in an environment that is not partisan, that welcomes everybody, that just wants to come up with solutions to emergency management challenges. And if it was hard to communicate emergency management last year, it's only going to be twice as hard to communicate it with the changes we see coming down the road. And as part of that, we developed 85 different training resources crossing that spectrum you listed earlier, congressional, intergovernmental, public affairs, and so forth, that our members have access to inform them. Also, any member at any time can call any other member or one of our board of directors or our advisors and seek off-the-record counsel and support to help them in their job. Somebody that, in a non-threatening way, you don't want to ask your supervisor, come here because we're a cadre of professionals who just want to see everybody succeed.
That's awesome. What are some of the goals that you all have for the organization in the next couple of years?
So we want a partnership with other organizations. We are in talks right now with the International Association of Emergency Management. And I hope that comes to fruition soon because they have an amazing network on an international scale of emergency managers. But we have in our membership the best and the brightest when it comes to communicators. Amongst our team, we have Robert Jensen, who at one time served on the NSC, DHS principal career public speaker, and FEMA career public speaker. We have Kelby Kennedy, who left FEMA as a political appointee, as the first advocate for tribal. I could go on and on. In every area, we have a senior expert. So we want a partner. That's just one example. Just the other day, I saw a gentleman on LinkedIn who's put together a local emergency managers alliance. I have not reached out to him, but I think that is another avenue because our membership includes everyone from international to national to federal to state to local to private sector. We already have folks representing every one of those categories on our team, and so we can be value added. And the third and final would be that international. With or without IAEM, we have so many international members that we're already seeing opportunities where we can help on an international level and not just here in the United States.
That's great. Dan, you talked about your level of energy. I mean, and I've known you long enough to know you don't like to sit still ever. But you are a columnist. You've written a book. You're teaching. We talked a little bit about your class before we started recording here. What motivates you to keep writing and teaching? How does that kind of connect with your previous experiences on the ground?
The three main jobs I've had in my life were to be a soldier, A civil servant, I like that phrase, over federal government worker. We are a servant to our society and to our nation. And even prior to being an adjunct professor at the university level, I was earlier in my career a high school teacher. And all those have one thing in common: it's serving others, right? That's where I did try the corporate world for a very short time. And I am glad that other folks take that yoke, but it's not mine to take, because I am more focused on, did I go to bed at night and help somebody? You know, today we did mock job interviews in my college class, and I could see that there's this one student who's always saying in previous speaking tests. And in this one, she went through it and didn't have a single right? And just to see that progress and to see the help. So to help people survive from a disaster, to help protect our nation, to help teach young minds, all help me sleep better at night and feel like I've given something back.
Your book that you published recently, Cultivate Your Garden, has a pretty unique title. Would you, for the folks listening to the or watching the podcast, would you share the story behind that and what that metaphor really means to you in the context of crisis communications?
So first of all, I'd say I probably could have sold more copies if I had a more direct title. But I was writing this for me and as a
Of
legacy to
course.
leave behind. And so I stayed true to who and what I am. So that comes from Voltaire's book, Candide. And a quick summary of the book is Candide is sort of led around the world by a sidekick, Kundaman, who shows him everything and tries to help him go find success, find the perfect world. Instead, what they run into is rape, death, malaise, murder, illnesses. It was just a horrible experience. And at the end of the book, Candide is actually in his garden, physically in a garden, planting and growing crops. And Kundaman comes to him again and says, "Hey, I'm ready to take that next trip." And the last line, he's Candide says, "Well, that's all well and good, but first we must cultivate our garden." And I took that to mean, and I explained this in the book, I think that's what we all need to do in our homes with our children and our families, but also in our professions. Not just be the best one at answering emails fast or doing what we're told. We need to cultivate our gardens and help things grow and bloom and leave it better than the way we found it.
I have your book on the desk behind me. I should have dug it out for the interview. I didn't think about that.
I
But
think
as
it's on the
a
desk behind me. I don't know.
Actually, you can see it behind you there. As a doctoral student, I only get to read for pleasure in the summer, so it's in the
Oh,
pile to read for the
I'm
coming
glad you describe mine as reading for pleasure. I'll take
year.
it.
One of the things that I wanted to talk about was the future of FEMA, which has definitely been a hot topic. I think since about the time of Hurricane Helene last fall, it got caught up in the turmoil of the election season and then all the changes going on right now. But as someone who spent a number of years in the organization, how do you see FEMA evolving from where we are today? There's even been suggestions about dismantling FEMA altogether and turning things over to the states, which was our pre, what, 1970s state of affairs here in the United States. What's your take?
So first, let me tell you what I don't see as the future: either where we were yesterday or completely dismantling it. I don't think either of those could be in any way intelligently defended. But as far as how it was yesterday, let me be clear. FEMA continues to evolve. So it has never been the way it was yesterday. So people who work at FEMA want to evolve it. People at FEMA come up with the best ideas oftentimes about how to evolve it. And we've had the Post-Katrina Reform Act and National Defense Act and some other things that have changed it. So FEMA doesn't look like it looked 20 years ago, and nobody expects it to look the same way 3 years from now. But dismantling it makes no sense. And I think folks have trouble seeing the bigger picture sometimes when they say the states could do this and the federal government should get out of the way. We're not just seeing in the current administration an expectation that the states will handle emergency management. We're hearing an expectation that they'll handle all the food banks in their communities. They'll handle all the health issues in there. And when you add up all the things that are being said or suggested that the state should handle it is absolutely not mathematically feasible. So there needs to be in our constitution and in our nation, a continued effective relationship between the states and the federal government. And the most important part out of that from FEMA that absolutely will stay, no matter what even if it's called something else, will be providing appropriate funds to a state when they've been overcome. Now, I still think there's balance to that. So if you ask the average American how many big disasters we had last year, they probably talk about the California wildfires and Helene and in the Carolinas and so forth. They may come up with a couple others, but there are well over 100 active disasters that FEMA is working on. So I do think it's a fair conversation to say, well, listen, if it was two counties and only this level of destruction, then I think maybe we could change the line of where federal assistance comes in. So I also think we have to look at what I called in my column a la carte options. So again, people like to reduce it down to a sound bite, but FEMA has like several different missions. So maybe what we change from preparedness is different from what we change in individual assistance, which is different from public assistance and is different in mitigation. And I do want to give one plug for mitigation because there's plenty of evidence, mathematically, financially, that shows an investment in mitigation saves dollars after the disaster hits for those who have mitigated. So I think that's the way we have to look at it. There has to be a rational assessment that includes local, state, federal, tribal, and private sector partners coming together to evaluate in a prudent way what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, I think it's tough for, I think there's a lack of knowledge about how emergency management works and who is responsible for what. I feel like there was a lot of that conversation happening during Hurricane Helene, for example. Even here in Minnesota, probably because our governor was the vice presidential nominee, the mutual aid conversation came up because, you know, what states were sending aid to North Carolina. And of course, you and I understand you don't just send aid. There's a process by which aid is requested and the right packages are sent from the right state that has the right resources that are the closest to be deployed in the right way. And Minnesota did wind up sending aviation assets and some other things. We sent an ambulance strike team and some other things along the way when they were requested and when we were the right state to send those things. I don't think folks really understand FEMA's role, particularly in response around providing that incident management assistance and coordinating the kind of logistical capability that U.S. Northern Command brings to a state to assist them with things the states can't do.
You know, I would say there's two main reasons for that. One is the complexity, and that's obvious. The second somebody tragically loses their home and they say, "Where's FEMA?" They miss 17 steps, right? There's their faith-based organization, their neighbor, there's their town, their county, the state, all the other state resources outside of emergency management. And even when you get to the federal government, there's more than FEMA. There's, Health and Human Services and Department of Energy and so many more. So I think that is part of it. But the complexity too of those programs, and anybody who's read the Stafford Act would have a hard time relaying that in a soundbite to people. And that's not the fault of FEMA. And by the way, a lot of politicians put together these acts and approved these acts and the Stafford Act, and they did so with a level of complexity. But the second issue that makes it hard to explain, and that I think outsiders don't always get, is there's a natural adversarial role. And it comes back to that money issue. So if I'm Joe Q Citizen in state, let's just call it state alpha, and I'm not happy and I complain to my governor, what would I do as the governor? Would I say, yeah, that's my fault and I should be taking care of that? Or is it easier to point the finger at FEMA, especially since FEMA never points the finger back? So FEMA's always turned the other cheek, and I have mixed feelings about that. I understand diplomacy and tact, but I think that to defend FEMA, I'd say more often than not, they've been blamed for something that's somebody else's fault. But to challenge FEMA, I'd say the way you handle that is to be factually dispassionate and tell the truth and let the consequences fall where they should.
It's definitely a challenge. I'll be curious where things wind up as we work through the challenges we're all facing right now. Dan, what advice would you give someone who's just now coming in, coming out of college, they're headed into their first comms or public affairs role? What would your advice be to them stepping out into their career for the first time?
Not to nitpick, but I got to say, it absolutely depends on which one. Because if they're coming to a crisis communications role that deals with emergency management, I would tell them, come in with your eyes wide open because you're coming into a landscape that's constantly changing and you need to read everything that's published every day to stay on top of a vastly changing and quickly changing environment. But for those just in general who are pursuing this field, I think there's some other common threads that are helpful to understand. One is that we have less and less living newspapers and less experienced journalists. I don't mean that as a slight to the journalists, but they are reducing in size. They've lost a lot of experience. And so they have a lot of young and upcoming people in that field. So to do public affairs effectively, there has to be an investment in educating the journalists on and the media at large on what your area is, the institution you represent, and what it all means. And doing that in a time of steady state and peace and not during a moment of crisis. And then in a world where misinformation and disinformation has become, I would actually use without hesitating the word rampant. It's a big challenge.
I would
And
agree.
adding to that, artificial intelligence. So you could even look at an image and, 5 years ago, you could assume you were looking at an actual image and you don't even know that anymore. That the challenge to people in the public affairs community is one, take everything with a grain of salt and do your homework to make sure you have a legitimate and actual source, not either artificial intelligence or something you were told that was not vetted. And then two, don't become part of the problem. Even when it hurts, tell the truth and work to what your institution is doing to make that truth a better truth tomorrow.
Last question, Dan. What's keeping you inspired? What gives you energy, hope, and purpose today?
What keeps me motivated every day is the hope for change and the opportunity to make the world a better place. And even when part of the world for any one of us at any given time may not be going well, there are other parts where we can make an improvement. And even in the parts that are going the most difficult for us, even making a little difference makes a big difference. And I'll finish by sharing paraphrasing because I don't have it memorized, but Ralph Waldo Emerson defined success. And part of his definition of success included planting a flower, making a small child laugh, winning the respect, earning the respect of friends. And doing just a few things like that, that's what gives me the hope and keeps me going. And even on my darkest day, I can see positive outcomes.
Dan, thank you for your time. I greatly appreciate you taking the time to be on the podcast with me today.
Yeah, thank you as well, Brian. I appreciate it anytime.
Thank you. That's it for this edition of the Managing Uncertainty podcast. I'll be back next week with another new episode. Be well.